bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello!
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Yo-ho, yo-ho!
And Bryce Castillo.
The bottle of rum for me, please.
Yeah, I am in my new little office here, and I haven't hooked up my microphone yet, so I'm actually using my little AirPods here. But it's a different environment for me here. The acoustics are different. So we'll be curious to see what happened during the summertime, though. I'm excited to see what happens. There's no AC in this office. Everything should be fine. Oof. Totally fine.
I'll open that window.
Does that mean that we are done with your old internet connection? This is the new, shiny, amazing internet connection?
Oh, you mean my fiber optic connection? Yes, this is what we're on right now.
Fancy.
Oh, God
damn! Two expenses in your future. One, a $99 window unit from Amazon. Number two, a short throw cardioid microphone that will not hear the blaringly loud sound of the $99 AC unit on the window.
This is the advantage of working with guys who've been doing this for years, is, you know, that, because I was looking at a window unit, but I'm like, yeah, I don't know if we'll be able to run it, you know, while I'm doing this. But
yeah, no, the these are more expensive. This is a Heil PR40, but if you get a good cardioid mic, I mean, keep in mind, for years and years, we would go to the loudest freaking bars and shoot Scam School episodes, and it was astonishing how even beyond the crowd noise would be like the copyrighted music we were able to have low enough. And, you know, it wasn't ideal from a production standpoint, but functional. I mean, we were able it's astonishing what a good short throw mic will do.
Yeah, no, that's very, very helpful. So I'll look into doing that.
Hold on. What kind of entertainer would be in the need of any kind of home broadcasting? I mean, like who would possibly need to learn such lessons aside from every radio station and television station that produces live content? Aside from them, name me one person who would need to learn these lessons, Brian.
Also late night hosts and also literally everyone. as a matter of fact, I'm starting to hear podcasts treated as a novel thing, to podcast from home. As a matter of fact, the Reply All podcasts were like, this is so crazy. I'm in my attic. He's in his office. We're both at home. It's wacky. Welcome to the club, people.
See, the numbers say podcasting has listening has gone down. Well, I mean, I don't know how accurate that is, but I saw the report.
Yeah, because everybody's too busy making their own podcasts.
Well, no one's driving. Less people are driving. Most people, you know, drive or listen while they drive.
I mean, you might be a big packer for it, you know. And I think I rarely listen to podcasts in the home. There's something I do when I leave the house, you know. So we'll see. I think it looks to be pretty good news. And man, you know, we talked about Strato launch a while ago. That was Paul Allen, one of the Microsoft founders. He was a big space enthusiast.
Strato launch was the one that had the crazy, like, double. It was like two 7457s in tandem, holding hands, carrying a rocket with them.
That's the one. Like, yeah, Paul Allen, of the three people who were putting in a ton of money, of the, you know, billionaires putting money into space, was Paul Allen, Elon Musk, and Jeff Bezos. When the untimely passing of Paul Allen was, you know, looked like things were in dire straits there for Strato launch, but they were able to get a backer and they are now back in business. And they just announced that they are putting together a new fleet of stuff. And yeah, utilizing, they have this humongous airplane, this huge airplane that's actually capable. There were designs back in the day when they were talking about working with SpaceX of like actually strapping a Falcon 9, you know, underneath that thing and dropping it. And then I think they parted ways for probably multiple reasons, but they've announced their own line of spacecraft. And you can see, if you go to the Strato launch page, part of what they're working on is like hypersonic craft, like things that go just ridiculously fast, including they formally announced that they do plan on building, there is the Black Ice, which is their fully reusable space plane, which would be a basically a craft that would, you know, probably have a booster stage two, but then would drop from the Strato launch vehicle and then reach orbit.
Wait, so, okay. So I hadn't really thought of Strato launch as being a contender for hyperfast global travel, but I guess that totally makes sense. Like, we were talking about, the BFR being able to essentially in 30 minutes get you from, you know, Seattle to Hong Kong or whatever, but maybe instead of 30 minutes, this is a 90 minute journey. And you know, your conventional craft up until the top of the atmosphere, and then you go for a roller coaster ride, and then you're there in an hour and a half. Have they announced any plans for like commuter purposes for within the Earth?
Nothing along those lines yet. They're talking right now more for research, the ability to use this stuff for like research. You know, hypersonic platform has a lot of utility for military research, etc. And that would probably be who, because they're looking at, you know, Mach 6, okay? So you're looking at, you know, the military applications like that. And I'm sure down the line there are some thoughts of like, oh, if we can make this more widespread, what have you, that, yeah, it'd be cool to do that.
I think right now, anybody who's in this space is looking at, they're running the playbook that SpaceX has run, right? And that's primarily build your equipment, have your business be feeding the gigantic amount of money that is coming from space and government and private industry to access space. On top of that, the platform is yours to build whatever you want on.
Yeah, if you click on the link for the Talon A, you can see where they're talking about like the applications, data services, instrumentation and experiments, things like this. So if you want a way to sort of test this sort of stuff, very interesting. A lot of it probably is code for some of the sort of military applications too.
Yeah.
So I'm just reading some of the,
Yeah. I mean, that's where the money is, right? That's how you make this kind of stuff worth it a lot faster. And then once you've proven your track record and in terms of, the engineering and you understand what your costs are each time you're going up on a more realistic, realistic way, then I think that there's a lot that you can build on. But I would so much rather see this, and then 2 years in, 3 years in, let them make their money, let them interact with the government, let private industry be the one that's taking a lot of risks, and then, you know, we think about getting from New York to Hong Kong in 45 minutes. Like,
so they talk about the Strato launch carrier, which is the largest airplane in the world. This would be able to launch three of these at a time.
Wow.
So kind of a neat concept. So
what kind of payload would each one have?
Each vehicle weighs like 6,000 pounds. As far as what kind of payload they'd have, I don't know what this version, and this is, you know, this is sort of their test bed sort of craft. And then I think part of what they want to do is you work on this, you use this, you figure out your systems, then figure out how to scale up from there to whatever you want to do. And that's, you know, what we saw what SpaceX did, which was very smart. And, you know, what Blue Origin does to their own is you start with a smaller scale thing. You know, SpaceX said, okay, we want to build an engine, so we're going to build a single engine rocket, you know, which will build the Falcon 1. And once we know that engine works, then we can build a bigger cylinder, put more engines there. Blue Origin, same thing with their engines and what they worked on, but they started just doing suborbital, you know, flights with new. But you build a thing, you get that first stage to work, rather than say, oh, there are some companies are like, oh yeah, no, we're gonna from the get go, we're gonna try and build ourselves a fully, a reusable space plane or whatever. And it's like, nations failed at that. That's hard.
Yeah.
Build that incremental step, you know, solve that small hard the problem. You think that like, yeah, we think we got this problem. Like, solve that. Find an application for it, which I think is clever. Like, yeah, we think we can do this, but if we can get customers for it, then we can get money to keep doing it. Then we can build that next thing and eventually work our way up to, you know, a space plane, which would be amazing because that would be, I think, a fully reusable system, which would be nice to have an alternative. You know, we're excited. We're Blue Origin's going and SpaceX going, but yeah, let's have alternatives.
So
sure. Yeah. Cause you want that price to come down and more so, when we talk about ideas having DNA, right? Like this is part of it in real time. Like you are seeing progress comes when you learn from the people that have successfully done stuff before and then go forward.
Do we know anything about the money that was invested in this, where it came from or what they're into, what they're like? Are they cool?
I don't know. I was trying to figure out who that is right now, who put investment into that. I don't know if they went and got multiple backers.
8% stake from coronavirus COVID. No!
Space News says transitioned ownership from Vulcan, which was Alan's company, to an unnamed organization that has been found out to be Cerberus Capital Management, a private equity fund.
Okay. I have heard of that company before. That's money. Money wanting to make more money.
They guard the gates of hell, I believe.
Yes.
Yes.
A three-headed operation.
If you play the music, they go to sleep. So I'm very excited about that. I'm just so glad to have, because I was like, man,
yeah, it was a bummer because, like, you want as around the world in so many days, like, you want as, or the Cannonball Run, you want as many different wacky ideas being tried at once. You know, it's like the reusable rocket, the single stage in orbit, the airplane that carries a little space shuttle and flings it up there.
Yep. I'll give you another cool space news thing. I actually got several stories here. Is there's a company called Lynk, LYNK, and they did an experiment about a couple weeks ago, which was really cool. And it's cool if you appreciate how cell phones work and what they do and what they don't know. Cell phones, you know, I think most people know, is they're called cell phones because they have antennas that are nearby. You know, the idea was let's break up, instead of having big, huge transmitters, let's have smaller phones, but let's put smaller, you know, less expensive transmitters, you know, every 1,000 meters or something, just break a thing into a bunch of small little zones. So your cell phone goes from little cell block to cell block to cell block. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the advantage of that is, like I said, cell phones can be extremely small. You can hold a phone in your hand because it doesn't have to send that signal terribly far. Well, Lynk was thinking, like, what if, could you communicate to a cell phone, a regular cell phone, not a satellite phone, but a regular functional, just like an iPhone, from space, by using a specifically sort of targeted signal, using multiple satellites that account for, like, the Doppler shift and the signal being sent down, et cetera. And they actually were able to do this. They had a satellite, and they were able to run an experiment where they were able to send a signal. They had somebody to the Falkland Islands, not known for good cell phone signal, and they were able to send, like, a text message alert to a person there, to a group there on the ground there, using a satellite. And wow, they say they'd actually be able to send text messages back up. And this might be a thing where, you know, it might be doing things with your regular cell phone antenna, like trying to stretch out, you know, the signal or how it does, or repeating things like this. There's a lot of probably cleverness that goes in there. But yes, this is a cool thing. They're now able to send text messages, like very simple data signals, to conventional. Again, there is no special antenna. There's nothing that's on here other than just software. They can take a regular iPhone or Android device, put their software on it, and it's capable of getting information from space.
I guess that makes sense, because when it comes to radio transmissions, we learned a little bit of this when we learned about ham radios and stuff on the Mono Rogue. Like, you either need exquisitely sharp ears. Let's say the satellite, you know, has a giant, for example, like think of the Arecibo radio telescope. It's just a giant dish that's a very big ear that's able to listen for radio signals from space. So even though they're extraordinarily faint, the ear is so big it's able to listen. And then likewise, to transmit from the satellite, you just need to be loud enough. You got to have enough power to blast it down that the weak receiver is able to hear it. And so it sounds like by using multiple satellites, and this is only going to get more powerful with the Starlink satellite array going out, then you're able to sort of create a virtual giant parabolic big ear to listen for very faint signals.
Well, I mean, the Starlink would be, it's a very different tech, very different bandwidth, what have you. I mean, what I mean is
as the entire sky becomes covered in a grid, then mm-hmm. it becomes easier to have not just one satellite listening for a transmission, but arrays of them aggregating that signal and putting it together.
Yeah, you would certainly, absolutely. I think that more satellites would increase the sort of throughput. I think there's going to be some pretty, it's going to be really hard at a certain point beyond that, because the way you're still going to get a lot of noisiness the more things you have in an area. So you're probably going to be limited to the kind of data you can do, because it's going to be, you're still going to be trying to pick up one conversation in a stadium sort of thing. And well, so it'll be,
actually a really good example, because that's quite literally what they do with those parabolic microphones during NFL games, is they literally overhear a single conversation in the middle of a huge stadium.
Well, yeah, but they're trying to do it on the field where there's fewer players. They're isolated from other people. But if you have like 12 people together, it's harder. But yeah, and it is a good example saying it's good for here when they're a little bit spread out. You can pick it up from far away. But when a group of people are together, you're going to get a lot of crosstalk. But, you know, we'll see. I don't know. I mean, I can only speculate as to what's in the, the conventional news article. But it's exciting. I mean, the idea that you could have emergency responders and people like this to say like, hey, yeah, no, when you're in the middle of, when I was, doing a Shark Week thing in the middle of the ocean, I'm off, halfway in Antarctica. And, I have to use thankfully Motorola let me borrow one of their satellite phones, which is useful. But, for a regular person, be able to take your regular phone out and do that. Awesome.
That's a game changer. And those are the things that I like the best because it brings the tech more to a tangible reality if you don't need your own hardware.
Yeah. I could see, they're going to do an experiment where they have another like small satellite they're going to launch from the International Space Station. Apparently it's already up there. They can do that. And we've looked at how, Facebook and some of these other companies have been looking for ways like, how do you connect people the last mile? And this isn't going to be good for video and that, but they have that low bandwidth version of Facebook that they use in lesser developed countries. Because just the ability for somebody who's, let's say, you live in equatorial Africa or whatever, you want to be able to participate in markets. You want to be able to participate in your economy. And if you're remote, it's hard to do that. But we've seen how transformative cell phones have been for that. And to give people those opportunities there and first responders and other places, it's exciting.
You want to know what else is exciting? The folks who keep this show running. Guys, hi, it's me, Justin Robert Young. I do the Weird Things podcast with two of my best friends in the whole wide world. And we really love doing it. Boy, howdy. And we do it because people listen. And the best people who listen also give us money at patreon.com/weirdthings. Not only do you get the episode early, you get the After Things show early. You get it on your own custom RSS feed. It's so easy. You put it into the podcatcher, your choice. And it just fills our hearts. Look. Folks, we love you. Patreon.com/weird.
There, we said it. You don't have to say it back, but you could just, slip us an old George Washington if you love us back.
Exactly.
Or Franklin.
Yeah, why not?
Hey, our Harriet Tubman, we're not picky.
Exactly. Do what you need.
They're Patreon. Not real yet, but they should be. So this is a cool story. This was actually in the hopper, but also tweeted at us. I admire the spirit of trying to solve problems and get things done. And
sounds like a setup for Damning with Faint Praise. I admit I admire the spirit of trying. ..
Dr. Daniel Reardon, a research fellow at Melbourne University, is concerned, like, as I say this, I did the very thing we're not supposed to do, and Justin just did the thing, too. Touching your face.
Oh.
Not supposed to touch your face.
Oh, my gosh. For the record, it has been a chronic thing. For anybody who's been watching any of the live streams, I had a cold 3 weeks ago, and since then, it's taken a very long time to get everything all fully cleared up, but my eustachian tube is still swollen, and I don't want to go to the doctor because I don't want to be around sick people, especially since everything online says you just got to wait and it'll be fine. But I have been like I'm on a plane constantly, equally like you can actually, man, I part of me wants to stick a microphone in there so you can hear it squeaking. Just immediately my right ear goes deaf. I probably touch my face twice a minute, every minute, all day, every day. And that's not great.
Yeah, just hearing you mention touching your face, I'm resisting every effort in the world to try to touch my face. So Dr. Reardon wanted to work on this solution, had a solution for this. And he thought, what if you built a system or something that warned you when you brought your hands near your face? Now, I found wearing gloves is super helpful because you're very aware when you're touching gloves to your face. And so if I'm out in public, I'm always wearing gloves, which is you're like, no, I'm not going to touch that. But He apparently tried some different things. He tried like an antenna around the neck, but the problem it was always going off. And his defense is like, I'm an astrophysicist. I work at these really huge waves. This is a different area of physics for me. And then he apparently decided that, well, what if I built something much more simple? Like you could use a magnetometer. There's very simple little things like reed switches, which they can open or close in the presence of a magnetic field. And I assume that's maybe something he worked on. He thought, what if I put magnets in my nose?
What?
And then when I bring my hands, like I have a device to detect it. Now, apparently, the problem was he decided to put one magnet. And again, a mistake I could see myself making. I'm not criticizing. He put one magnet in one nostril and said, well, two is better than one. And he put the other magnet
in the other nostril.
Here's the thing many people may not know about magnets. They stick together. And so he basically had two magnets stuck to each other inside of his nasal passage and had to go to the doctors to have them removed. Thank you, doctor. I appreciate listen, I want more experiments, more people trying stuff. If every now and then you got to go to the hospital to have a magnet removed from your nose, if it leads to some development that helps people, it's worth it.
All right. Number one, everybody who always goes out on Twitter, believe scientists. Why don't we pay attention to science? Look, I'm on this guy's side. Sometimes science is ugly. Sometimes science is stupid. Sometimes science, with your best intentions, lead you to do something where you don't realize that you're doing something that eventually is you're so far deep into the forest you can't see the trees, and you have to go to the ER because you got magnets stuck in your nose.
Also,
this is what science looks like.
This is what a hero looks like. I mean, in an alternate reality, this dude came up with a system that saved the whole world. Speaking of which, I wonder if...
But also, just for the record, this guy admits that he has no expertise with building circuits, and the device that he created only works unless you move your hand close to your face.
They said the same thing about Ford and Edison and
bicycle mechanics. A couple of bicycle mechanics in Ohio.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. They built a little thing called space. No, airplanes. But you know what it makes me think of? Do you remember we talked about this device a while ago? The Pavlok, Pavlok.
Yes.
This guy created a device that you could program on your smartphone that would deliver a mild shock. That seems like that would be super easy to reprogram this bracelet to, you know, when it senses you, you train it on what it looks like when your hands move to your face, and then it just gives you a little tweak and says, hey, buddy, knock that off.
Yeah. If he had been into machine learning, he would have come about this in a very different way. And you certainly could. We've seen with the Apple Watch how you can train the thing to tell the difference between an intentional fall and an unintentional fall. And if you had two on each, you know, one on each wrist, which we would like to have a lesser, you know, sophisticated way to solve this problem. But we haven't been very good at that since the guy touching his face right now. But yeah, you could train that. Like you just said, you could probably a device like that. It very easily train it. And like, I think it's a solvable thing through tech. It's just,
you know what, is it worth it? Even as you were talking, I realized that by virtue of wearing glasses, it becomes a natural thing every minute or two to just push it up on the bridge of my nose, which makes it even less likely that I could get away without touching my face.
Yeah. So
I mean, like, can I ask a question that might be, I might be as dumb as the dude who shoved magnets up his nose, but like,
I'm not saying
he meant brave. He meant brave. He might be as brave as that guy.
I'd be as brave by asking a question that might reveal myself to be stupid. If all you're doing is sitting at home and washing your hands, I mean, a face touch here and again, like
it's not. So yes, but I think part of it is just you want to break the habit. And the idea that if you're conscious of it when you're at home, then when you're out in public, you'll be even more conscious of it. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I've same thing. Like, it's me and my girlfriend, we had a repairman come in and fix a drawer. And the first thing we do after we left, like, oh, thanks, locked the door, disinfected everything that he touched, everything he was near, you know, because we're just trying to be that super cautious. So I would expect that it's just our germs in here. But Again, breaking that habit.
I was going to ask if 1 week ago I had discovered that website that I forwarded over to Justin, that that healthdata.org site. Did we talk about this last time? According to a Reddit post, this is help financed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, but it's covid19.healthdata.org. And I found it really surprisingly comforting in that it, on a state-by-state basis, it takes the latest data day by day, and it knows how many hospital beds are available in the general populace. It knows how many are available in the ICU on a state-by-state basis, and it makes a projection for each state of when it's going to hit peak resource usage. It does make some assumptions, like the fact that it assumes we're going to keep on doing social distancing the way we are right now, but it gives sort of a tangible timeline that is somewhat comforting in that you can at least see a light at the end of the tunnel. It's a bummer that that light is on the other side of a mountain where things are going to get busier and busier. But for example, here in Texas, oh, wow, this is wild because the peak resource use was April 19th, but now it's pushed back and it says that peak resource use in Texas will be on May 2nd. So my guess is that could be an indication of the curve actually flattening, but it looks like even at peak resource use, as of now, the estimates are that there'll be more beds than people, maybe less so for the ICU side of things.
What's the URL for that again?
It's covid19.healthdata.org.
For those who watched the press conference in the Rose Garden yesterday, there was a lot of discussion by Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx of the Murphy model. If this is not the Murphy model, then this seems to track similarly with what they were talking about. I wasn't able to find if this is the exact same model, but it is one of the models that I know they were looking at. Apparently there's 12 going around, but this actually has the death toll on the lower end of 100,000, which was the number that got floated not only by Dr. Fauci in the press, but also during the press conference yesterday.
Yeah, and for a moment too, I think what's interesting what they talked about too was that they split into two groups. Basically, there was another group that was also doing their modeling to try to figure out what they thought, you know, the ideal time was and where this was. And then when they met and they said, yeah, we came to this conclusion, like, yes, we had the same conclusion. And, you know, it was a very interesting thing, a very interesting approach. Like, how, if you're looking for something to read, a great book is in a book that I say this before, the problem with this book is often people give you the thought that sort of the Cliff Notes version, which is actually almost 180 degrees opposite of what the book really talks about. And that's the Wisdom of Crowds by James Surowiecki. And it gets into the idea that if you want to find kind of, if you want something, if you want to get information about something, one is you can pool a large group of people and then put that data together and look for averages. With sometimes what will happen is the wild guesses on either side will sort of cancel each other out and the more reasoned ones will sort of agree and reinforce. But the problem happens is if somebody says, okay, we'll go into a room and we'll ask 30 people, let them debate and then have them vote. And that's the opposite approach, because what will happen there is the most persuasive person there we'll get everybody on board to their opinion, and then we lose all the outlier and the other stuff that can reinforce it. And that was one of the most critical things about the book, is you'd be like, oh, yeah, ask a bunch of experts, pull their opinions together. It's like in isolation, independent, have people independently come to those conclusions, because you've been in a room where like, oh, I think this, like, nah, we'll talk to you. They talk a person out of a point of view. And then later on, you find out like, no, we would have been maybe more close for that. So here, one of the first steps they talked about doing was sort of like kind of let's start over and look at the models and figure out what we need to do here. Let's look at multiple models. Meanwhile, in another group apparently was doing a similar thing, and then they met and they're like, wow, okay, our answers converge, which, you know, is a very healthy way to try to figure out, you know, what you want to do. So
yeah. Also, just a real quick follow-up. So this indeed, the website that Brian just gave is by Christopher J.L. Murray, the professor and director of the IHME, which put this together. So this is the model, the Murray model, that not Murphy, the Murray model that they were discussing. And, you know, obviously this is being used to help guide some of our public policy. And it is certainly worth looking at. And although there are some grim elements here, including, you know, days ahead where we might lose
over 2,000 Americans in a day for close to a week. At the very least, it does have glimmers of hope, like population centers in California, Texas, Illinois, and Florida staying under the most catastrophic scenarios, which right now seem to be playing out in New York and Michigan and Louisiana specifically.
Yeah. And it's a grim sort of scenarios and stuff. And I think it is helpful to sort of look to at other places around the world, other Western countries, and how they're trying to face this too. And, you know, what's the right response, whatever, you know, hard to know, but you look at other places that are dealing with this challenge too. And there are no easy answers.
No, as it turns out, it's a global pandemic.
Yeah.
Traditionally, not something that everybody, there's a highly realistic, if not extraordinarily probable scenario where we come out of this and we have survived this global pandemic worldwide better than any such in history. Right. And we look back and say, hey, look, what a great way we survived something like this. But, you know, all we can do is stay safe now and try to follow the guidance that we have.
Yeah, one of the potential casualties of this is the company OneWeb, which when we were talking about building satellite constellations around the Earth, OneWeb was one of the earliest ones out there. I think the first ones to put up a large group of satellites. There are competitions with SpaceX, Starlink, and they had done a number of launches, but then they were looking to do another funding round and try to continue on. But apparently that they have filed for bankruptcy, citing COVID-19 as a factor for that. Wow. Whether or not that was ultimately, but
I have I hesitate to call it a good thing, but I have a COVID weird things story. Did you guys see, like, directly attributable to the fact that everybody was hunkered down for COVID-19, almost certainly saved multiple lives when a massive tornado touched down live during the news? I think this was 2 days ago in Arkansas. Did you guys see this footage? They're given the weather report. The local weatherman is like, hey, they're downgrading and they're calling off this tornado weather warning. Looking at the data, I think they shouldn't have done that. I say be really careful. And they've got, you know, most local news stations have their local camera just poking out a window. And sure enough, you watch live as it forms a funnel cloud and then touches down and then just becomes super massive, ripping up debris, whipping it all around. Apparently went through a mall, destroyed the whole thing, but nobody was there because they were all hunkered down for COVID-19. They only had 5 serious injuries. It's remarkable watching. I don't know if Bryce is able to find it or not.
I can't find that footage. It looks like maybe the injury counter is up to 22, but I don't see any information about deaths. So.
The story I'd heard was that there weren't any deaths. Let me see if I can find that video footage, because it's fairly remarkable.
Yeah, that is the other side of it, is because when you're not able to go about your normal activities, you know, the harm reduction from that. You know, but the other side of it, though, is, you know, there are people who are needing medical attention or elective stuff, and it's, you know, you're thinking second, guessing yourself and being able to do that. So, but yeah, certainly a situation here, like, holy cow, we're looking at a tornado ripping through a town. And wow, looked like it just hit some, like, electrical junction box or something. You got a bunch of sparks and things.
Yeah. Doggone it. It looks like, let's see. I guess I'll search tornado live news and see if that pops up for the last week.
It could also be this footage that we're looking at here.
No, it's it was definitely like the weatherman is standing in front of the tornado the whole time, and it's like he gets asked to step off screen for a little bit, and then he steps back on so he can point to different various things. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah, anyway, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, if you worked at, like, you know, the hot dog stand at that mall and you're at home and you watch this happen, you're thinking, like, man, God loves me. You
know? Yeah.
But not everybody else.
It is pretty wild, too, because of the vantage point. When you're on the highway, you can't really, because of the buildings, you can't see the way the camera on the top of this building could. So you're just watching this thing go towards the highway and just all of these cars heading right towards it. And then there is a brief moment that it crosses over a public street. You start seeing some pretty sharp U-turns as people are clearly driving right towards this massive, like, F4.
somebody's got like got my gloves on, got my mask, you know, I wiped everything out with disinfectant. Now let me go get some milk.
Yeah, right?
Honey, what happened? Where's the coffee? Not happening today. Gentlemen, you want to do picks?
I got a pick. I don't know if I like or hate this show. I don't know if the show likes or hates its protagonists, but I've started watching The Crown on Netflix.
Huh.
And if you liked Downton Abbey and you liked House of Cards, but you want it to be a version of, you know, reality that's actually happened, specifically the ascension of Queen Elizabeth, who is still Queen of England, then I would recommend it. The first episode was a little slow, but essentially it gets into kind of a each episode is sort of a slice of life of like, you know, 24 to 72 hours of a crisis that happened, you know, for the queen or the government. And, you know, there's just moments when I'm watching it and I'm like, is the most like powerful person who got to be powerful by birthright, like, is this the most sympathetic protagonist? Like, even when they have the problems, it's like, oh, okay. All right. But I'm enjoying it. And there are moments where I very much enjoy it. And there are moments where I'm like, okay, I don't know how much I care about these particular problems. But John Lithgow plays Winston Churchill, and that's worth the price of admission.
Oh, hells yeah. My pick is Half-Life Alyx. It's good. If you have a VR, if you've been waiting for that AAA awesome, massive multi-hour experience, if you've been looking for a game that's more than a party demo, then man, oh man, you cannot do better than Half-Life Alyx. It is fantastic, engaging. Took me the better part of three and a half days to finish, give or take. I think total playtime was maybe 16, 17 hours. I took my time because it was so tasty and delicious. I loved it. It's the defining VR experience. It is heavy on the suspenseful kind of zombie-like high tension stuff, and those moments can be a little bit frustrating when you perceive that it's not so much your lack of skill so much as a lack of tracking on the controllers or something that's causing you to not be able to get things done. But it's fantastic. It's super, super great.
I have a pick. It's an obscure thing, and I think that once people pay attention to it, it'll get a little bit of attention maybe. It's called a Netflix documentary called The Tiger King.
Oh, baby!
Number one show in America, apparently, like by the numbers.
It's the show we need right now. It's the show we need right now. I don't want to, no spoilers or whatever, although everything is sort of set up right at the beginning. I'm going to say that it's amazing when you watch something and as far as you know, you feel it's, I assume it's accurately portrayed. Who knows? I mean, the documentaries, the problem is every time I walk out of a documentary, I go like, okay, I watched some footage and I watched a thing and I think this is what they want me to think. And I think this is probably what happened, but you know, the shortcuts and you know, the stuff and documentarians are the most prejudicial of any kind of filmmaker there is. You know, they're the ones that clear because you're willing to spend 3 years or 4 years of your life putting something together. You do it because you have a point of view on something. And so that's always when I'm mindful whenever I watch something, like, don't believe what I like, walk out of there and look for the contrary opinions, whatever, because you're going to find out it's often more complicated, whatever. But assuming, you know, and nothing I saw on Wikipedia sort of contradicted it, whatever. You watch a thing and you kind of walk away going, the person you know who did stuff wrong, like really, really, really wrong, you know, the evidence is very overwhelming. They did something wrong versus the person who maybe did something wrong in the past. But we don't really kind of know, but was ultimately basically about them trying to do something right. You're more sympathetic to the person who did something really, really wrong because they're so charismatic. You know, and you're like, you know, it's like an HBO show, you know, where like you're the anti-hero, where you're like, man, this person's amazing. And like, yeah, maybe they did these horrible things, but so.
Yeah.
I thought, very well done.
We rewatched the first two episodes on Saturday because we were talking to a friend of ours who she is like a massive animal lover. Like she is literally stopped on the side of the road because there was a three-legged bunny that she in her apartment now lives with. She took in a disabled bunny that she saw on the side. That's how much she loves animals. And we were like, you gotta watch it. The tiger stuff is, it's a part of it, but it's not the point of it. Like it gets far beyond, this tiger dispute. And so she sat down and watched the first two episodes. But man, that turn in the last 5 minutes of the second episode, that then is the entirety of the third episode, just one of the most like hairpin wild turns I have ever seen in a documentary. And beyond that, no, to go to your preamble, Andrew, the thing that I did like about the doc is that a lot of the crazy stuff, it's just set on camera. Like, so like, yeah. Yes, you can presume that there are things that are shaved to make sure that the message kind of gets across. But, you know, I was joking on the stream the other day that a lot of times if you have a condition somewhere that you are talking to the people involved in it and you want to get them to say it, documentaries tend to have these tricks, right? And one of the tricks are like, you'll have, let's say somebody's like in like a cult-like situation, you'll have people describe what they're doing, right? And then you'll like cut to somebody else saying, well, a cult, like an FBI guy saying, well, a cult is defined by all these things. And you'll just put those things next to each other. Not the case with this documentary. Like, you just have people out and out saying, like, well, I got my cult. He's got his cult. You know, we're just kind of cult leaders, I guess. Like, I prefer the way I'm running it. Like, there's just so much where the words just kind of tumble out. These characters are so visceral that they just, I think that combined between the three of them, Joe Exotic, Carol Baskin, and Doc Antle blink like a combined seven times. Like they are all just like have these kind of like wide, but when they do blink, they're like doozies. It's like, you're like, oh my God, there's something going on.
And then Tim Stark, who anybody who gets to do an interview and just having a monkey casually hang around his neck all the time, you see this guy working, you know, a ditch digger, and there's this monkey just hanging out around. I'm like, how did I miss this job? I didn't know that was on there. It was an application for that.
So I, with the popularity of Tiger King, I've encountered a surprising phenomenon to me because I was hooked. I gobbled this thing up in like 2 days. It was insane. But now I'm encountering people who cannot bring themselves to even get past the second episode. Like Bonnie tried, like she genuinely tried and just hated everything about every second of the first episode and every clip she's seen. She doesn't like a single moment of any of it. Spoiler alert coming up for Cord Killers. Tom was not able to get close to finishing it. He rage quit in the second episode because he just hated every second of it. I think that's, I mean, it's a legitimate position too, because there's a lot of ugliness in there. I don't blame. I mean, that's kind of the whole disaster that we're watching is all of the ugliness.
Yeah. I mean, we spoiler territory. What is, I mean, is mild, is it that we, the turn that one of the characters we realize about their past that's throwing people, or?
I mean, it's all, they start doling that out. It's the second episode. They talk about, what's his name? Doc. And
Antle.
Yeah. That's where they start talking about the structure of his organization, right?
Yes.
And then it just gets uglier from there. I don't know if we're just gawking or just constantly surprised. I mean, it's a bit, I kind of hate myself. It's a bit like the beginning parts of an American Idol season. Where,
oh yeah, it's all messy drama. I mean, what is a cool theme of the show is they all hate each other, and the only reason they like pretend to protect each other is because they are all guilty of the same crimes, full stop.
Literal crimes.
Yeah. Like, yeah. They the only reason that they have any good things to say about each other is because if one goes down, then they will take all of them down.
Yeah, it's a trade that, like, that wild animal, you know, like, trade is a thing that you get people who for years get away with doing things that were wrong, and then you just sort of get conditioned to the idea, well, it's okay because nobody's getting in trouble. Then all of a sudden you get in trouble. I'm like, wait, what? And then everything sort of falls apart. But yeah, I'm surprised. Like, I mean, we have to talk maybe when we can get into spoilers about why. I can't imagine why somebody would stop after that second episode, because it's where you get into this sort of insight of these personalities. And, you know,
well, I think Bonnie's take, and I don't think I'm talking out of school speaking for her, is that just everyone is a hideous, awful person, and she doesn't understand why she would sign up for 5.5 more hours of hideous, awful people.
I think that, and I guess that, I would say the same about every HBO drama. And I would say the thing is that, yes, and there, it's like, to me, it's like, it's a documentary about douchebags. It is a documentary about douchebags, but you see some of them have their personality quirks. Like, oh, this person, like, you really like this part of this person, and you really like this part of this person. Like, yeah, man, I wish they didn't like do these horrible things. Like, I'm pretty sure they did those horrible things. And then you find yourself, some of these characters are still doing stuff. And, you know, my girlfriend was watching one of the Instagram live videos from one of these people the other day. Yeah, last night, because it's like fascinating to sort of watch this sort of thing and see the animals and stuff. And then the other side of it, you're like, yeah, but this is a thing they did. And for me, that's the thing, is that, like, you know, we grew up, you know, just like we grew up in South Florida, and you get a lot of crazy personalities. And I didn't know the guy that was center to this sort of story, but I had a friend that I think knew him pretty well. And I had, you know, and so I had to occasionally take care of a mountain lion. And so I came in contact with other people in that world, and you meet people who are really cool, likable people. You like these sort of people. And then you're like, yeah, but there's this other thing. And you're like, oh, that sucks, but I like this person. Like, oh yeah, but then there's this other thing. You're like, oh, okay. And I think that's what the documentary to me was like. Most of these people were very likable, very, very likable. And then you find out these awful things that they've done. And it's not that, yeah, it's like reality is messy. You know, like that, you know,
at the heart of it, if I was going to guess, like, ultimately, and I think Bonnie would agree with this, she just couldn't handle seeing those teeth. I think that's the alpha and the omega of the whole thing, is aesthetically, she couldn't handle the teeth.
It is an unpleasant. I mean, there's a lot of unpleasantness to that entire situation, to all those situations, like even when you get into. You know, some of the stuff that you get into in episode 3, and you start to take a closer look at that organization, and you have to start asking yourself realistically, like, exactly how different are these scenarios of this one to the other. It's a show that I think has caught the public attention deservedly. Obviously it's not going to be for everybody, because it's, you know, nothing is for everybody, but oh my God. It is certainly something that I have enjoyed talking, living vicariously through my friends who are seeing it for the first time.
Well, and now we're to the point where I'm so infected with the Tiger King bug. I sent over to Justin, John Rael sent me a link to this like 12-minute documentary on the movie Roar that I think it's good, bad movies. Did a little short recap of the whole thing.
Oh, and, wow.
Yeah. Legitimately the most dangerous movie ever made, the most irresponsible movie ever made. 70 people were injured on set, and that's only counting the ones that actually went to the hospital. And the idea of the movie was, what if a bunch of cats moved into a derelict house, and they asked around, and including in the cast is Melanie Griffith, and it's her family, and they asked around, hey, how would we do this if we wanted to have a lot of big cats? And they said, don't. But if you did, you should start by raising them from cubs and have only family members as the cast. And so they immediately went to work doing that. They had over 100 big cats on the set. What's his name? Jan de Bont had over 100 stitches.
Guy.
Yeah, his the guy who went on to direct Twister and
Speed.
Oh, that's right. Speed. Yeah. Who still has a favorable opinion of the whole experience. It's remarkable. Bonkers.
I mean, if you just look at the things that made the movie, there are moments that are like, that just made the movie where tigers are mauling like famous actors. And you're like, one of those clips on a grainy cell phone now would get something shut down forever. Like, there's just, Melanie Griffith was mauled by a lion. There's one scene that I guess made the movie where they had a safe word
Director's name Noel was shout the director's name Noel, and then we'll shut down shooting. And so, unfortunately, Noel sounds delightfully enough like the word screaming no, as, you know, as you would say while acting, while a big cat mauls you, that that Noel, upon hearing his name, just decided to keep on shooting. So apparently the safe word meant nothing.
Yeah, just a remarkable story. And go. That is worth the watch. The Good Bad Movies rundown of Roar. It was absolutely fascinating, and I would encourage everybody.
Yeah.
It did lead to Tippi Hedren's continued interest in animal preservation, though. You know, as they, you know, it started off where like, hey, we went to Africa, these animals are special, we should make a movie, it's what we do, we're Hollywood people. And then maybe not such a good idea, but maybe let's find a way to care for these animals.
They definitely were raising just a lion as a pet. And I guess somebody from Life magazine found out and did this whole pictorial spread. It's just surreal. Kids playing in the pool with a giant freaking lion.
Yeah, that's the thing about like the different big cats and their temperaments and stuff, is that like lions let you know how they feel. And that's why sometimes people get into that sort of false sense of feeling safe around them, because you have lions and having a bad mood, you give them, you know, clearance and whatever. And you see people do crazy things with lions, like putting your head in the lion's mouth and stuff like this. Tigers change their opinion, change their moods really, really, really quick. And then, you know, you look at like where a lot of accidents happen with people who work with them. And because they'll think like, oh, because usually what you do is you move from one compound to another to go clean or put food or whatever. And you get the person who's maybe not the regular handler for it goes into clean, and they didn't do a head count. They didn't realize this. And the one of the things you never, ever supposed to really do is turn your back on any of them, because they just instinctually can't help them. And so you look at like, you know, you see people playing in a pool with a lion. It's like, oh, it's like a big dog. And it's not, you know.
Yeah, on that Roar documentary, they were talking about the or that short piece, they were talking about how traditionally you want two handlers for every one big cat. They had over 100 big cats and exactly two handlers, full stop.
What can go wrong?
The only person who didn't get injured was a guy who was from Kenya, who said, I will do whatever you want me to do, except for befriend these cats, because where I come from, I understand that this is not a good idea. He was the only one to not be injured. But
you want to know what? It actually reminded me of, remember the whole Cecil the Lion thing that happened a couple years ago? Shot, you know, a lion that had apparently been beloved by some element of society. And then I think it was in the Times. If not, it was somewhere else. But it was a guy from Africa who wrote the pro shooting Cecil the Lion argument that was like, lions kill people. I lived in Africa. If all the dentists in all the world could come into Africa and shoot all the lions, I would be far more happy than allow the lions to be free.
Cologne on his shoes. Yeah. That doesn't make sense. You'd want to put like like tuna oil.
Sardine oil.
Yeah.
She knew.
She already had that plan.
Oh, yeah. On the lion subject, too, it's like, hey, imagine that Brian's next door neighbor has a tiger compound and the tiger gets loose and there's a tiger in your backyard. What do you want to do? Shoot it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sympathetic to people in other countries where these things naturally live, but they're like, I mean, they are beautiful creatures and we need to figure out ways to conserve them and protect their habitats so human cat interactions don't happen in the same ways.
I got a pick.
Bryce, you have a pick?
Yeah. I started playing this when it came out last week or so. It is the new Animal Crossing New Horizons. You guys know about Animal Crossing?
Yeah, that's where you run a big cat park, right?
You could. I think you could. I think you would have a tough time. So actually, someone in the chat did share. So Animal Crossing, if you don't know, is like it's a very relaxing game where you can... where you live on an island and you have people who live with you and you can buy clothes and you have villagers and neighbors and you plant trees and stuff. It's very relaxing. Oh. And the thing that has been very fun is seeing people make Tiger King references in Animal Crossing like this one. Geez.
It's inappropriate, but just because you read it in that voice, the two word prefix to Carol Baskin's name. You can hear the audio peaking as that gets rolled out. I've been living in an Animal Crossing world. Pretty much all me and my wife do is work, and then I watch her play Animal Crossing, or we're watching whatever the Netflix or streaming thing of the day is. But a lot of Animal Crossing. It's a fairly remarkable game. I can see why it has kind of taken off, especially as everybody is cooped up, because it is just as much of a social network as it is any kind of linear gameplay.
What is the core gameplay dynamic? Is it like a collecting game, or
it's kind of akin to Minecraft. Like the series predates Minecraft a little bit, but you basically like you start on a deserted island with two other neighbors, villagers. And you are planting trees and selling stuff and earning money it's a lot of customization. You know, you can decorate your town and your home, as well as like terraforming and sort of taming the wilderness, if you will. And so it's not a lot of like, there's not like a boss or like stuff to do. You know, it has a very interesting dynamic of like. You could spend a lot of time playing it every day if you want, but for most people, they will probably spend 30 to 60 minutes a day, because there's only so much that you can do in a day, because it runs on real-time clock.
So it runs on the same time that you run and you interact with people, but like most of what I'll see is actually like talking with somebody on an app like that has its own VOIP. And you go back and forth and trade things, but it is this like nice core morphine for an anxious age.
Yeah. So Animal Crossing New Horizons, out now on the Switch.
Sweet. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.